12th, 1992. We're at the offices of Mr. Dick Raddatz, former major league pitcher with the Boston Red Sox, Cleveland Indians, Chicago Cubs, and Montreal Expos. And it also says in the book I had that you played with the Detroit Tigers, but I could find no statistics for that year. Okay, what I'd like to do, Mr. Raddatz, is start you off with where and when did you start playing ball? And I want you to include your youth and how you progressed through to Major League Baseball.
Okay. First of all, Peter, the name's Dick. I'm Mr. Raddatz was my dad. I'm just one of his mistakes. But I started playing baseball. Quite honestly, because my friends played it. I liked football and basketball a lot better. And as I say, I played it because my friends played it. I really didn't get serious about playing baseball until I was about a sophomore in college. Basketball was my first love, and I went to Michigan State on a baseball scholarship. And I really wanted to play in the NBA. But as it turned out, I didn't have as much talent as I thought I did, so I concentrated on baseball at Michigan State and had a good career there. I made All-American my senior year, and I signed with the Red Sox in 1959. Of course, went to Raleigh, North Carolina, and Carl Yastrzemski and I broke in together that year. Carl signed after his freshman year at Notre Dame, and the next 8 years we played together, and that was a treat for me. But that's how I got started, basically. I played all through high school in baseball, but here again, I wasn't as serious about that as I was basketball, number one, football, number two.
Okay. You're a relief pitcher. What other positions did you play in baseball before you became a relief pitcher? And did you have a difficult time making the transition from possibly a starting pitcher to a relief pitcher?
Well, of course, like every athlete worth his salt that played baseball in high school, I pitched and played first base and thought I was Babe Ruth, hit fourth in the whole nine yards. But quickly after I got into professional baseball, I found I wasn't as good a hitter as I thought I was. But I didn't play any other position in college, Peter. I played strictly pitched, and I was always a starter. But in 1961, my third year in professional baseball, I had started the year before and had an outstanding year at Raleigh and Minneapolis, a combination of the two teams. And I think I was something like 15-3 that year between the two teams. And as a starter, and I went to spring training in 1961 with Seattle, which was then our AAA farm club, and Johnny Pesky was the manager down there. And I pitched a ball game. I went down there with a sore arm. I had hurt it in the wintertime, and I went down and asked Johnny if I'd have a couple of weeks before I really had to do any throwing. I wanted to let the Florida sun work on it. And, well, 3 weeks had passed, and it was time to cut the ball club, and I hadn't thrown yet. And he said, Dick, we got to make a cut here. And he said, I can't justify keeping you if you don't throw. And I said, well, I understand. My arm still really bothered me. So good Lord was on my side. I went over to Daytona Beach and pitched against Rochester, which was the Orioles' AAA farm club, and I struck out 11 out of 12 in the first four innings starting. And, of course, I was elated. To this day, I don't know how I did it. My arm hurt so bad. But we came back to DeLand that night, and Johnny called me in his office and said, Dick, well, I don't think there's any doubt we're going to take you to Seattle with us. And I said, well, I appreciate that. And he said, well, we're going to take you as a relief pitcher. And I went right through the roof. Because in those days, quite honestly, it was a demotion. Mm-hmm. He felt people weren't good enough to be a starter. They simply went to the bullpen. And I had a tough time adjusting to it. Pesky said, I told Johnny, I said, you can send me to Allentown, which was our A ball club. I said, I want to pitch every 4 days. He said, well, I'm going to take you to Seattle with us, and I'm going to teach you how to pitch every day. And I said, I can't do that. Well, as it turned out, Peter, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I just didn't realize it at the time. And I had a good year in Seattle. I had quite a number of saves, and although my record was 5-6, as you know, it's tough to evaluate a relief pitcher on a win-loss record sometimes. But I did well, and I did pitch 3 or 4 times a week. I made the transition rather quickly, but I still felt like I was excess baggage on the ball club. I felt like I wasn't really a contributing member of the ball club. And even after the next year, I went to Boston and was fortunate enough to make the club, and I was the relief pitcher of the year in the American League in 1962. And still didn't feel that I was part of the ball club. And I guess in 1963 is when it really kicked in, and I realized, yes, I am an important part of this ball club. And, you know, it was just the attitude of relief pitchers, period, back in those days. And starting in about 19, I think I was probably, if not the first, one of the first relief pitchers that was ever groomed in the minor leagues to pitch relief in the big leagues. My old college roommate, Ron Baranowski, may have been another one. He came up in 61 as a reliever for the Dodgers and had a great career. But we were one of the, we were two of the first. You know, Hoyt Wilhelm was around then, Elroy Face. But at one time, they had all been starters, and they did well as reliefers. But we were two of the first pure ones, I think.
Okay, good. What were your relations with the other players on the team? Like you said, at first you thought you didn't fit in. How'd you get along with the players? Were there any that you became very friendly with and are still friendly with through today?
Oh, sure. Bill Mombouquet and I see a lot of the fellas with the old-timers games that we play now in different ballparks and Legends games and, of course, our fantasy camp, which we have every year that I'm deeply involved with, one of the owners, Red Sox fantasy camp. So we do see a lot of the fellas, but I became very close with, quite honestly, some of the fellas that I was close with on the Red Sox when I started out didn't really have big careers. Bob Hefner, Jack LeMabe, who was sort of my setup man in those days, although he wasn't called that. Bob Tillman, who was one of our catchers, and fellas like that, and we were very, very close, and unfortunately we don't see as much of each other as we'd like to, but when I went on to Cleveland, Gary Bell and I became very close. We still are. So athletics is a wonderful thing, whether you're black, white, or whatever. There's no racial overtones on ball clubs, at least there wasn't then. I don't see any indication of that right now. That's one wonderful thing about professional sports. Earl Wilson, who was the first black pitcher to ever pitch with the Red Sox, he and I to this day are very close friends, and that was the beautiful thing about professional sports. I had a lot of good friends, Peter, from baseball that I still associate with, and of course Carl I played with the longest, 8 years with the Red Sox, and we were never real close friends. We did a lot of things together, and of course as of today we still count each other as friends, but there were other fellows, as I mentioned, I was closer with.
The salaries. Mm. Do you remember your first salary?
I remember all of them.
Your highest salary, and thoughts on today's salaries. And before you answer that, I want you to take into consideration the situation that we have with Bo Jackson today and Tony Conigliaro and what happened to them.
When I was American League Relief Pitcher of the Year in 1962, Peter, I made $7,500. And Mr. Yawkey gave me a $5,000 bonus at the end of the year. I thought I'd hit the lottery. I thought I was the richest man in the world. At least it felt that way to me. For a total of $12,500 that year, that was really something. But not to belabor the point, when I left the Red Sox in 1966 to go to Cleveland, I was the highest paid player in the ball club. I made $42,500, a little bit more than Carl and Malzone, and of course Dick Stewart had a big salary in those years. But I was by a couple thousand the highest paid player in the ball club. $42,500 was an absolutely awesome salary in those years. And the average salary of the major league ball player in 1966 was $18,000. So I was markedly over that, and that's when I really felt I was part of the ball club. But you know, a funny story, and I won't make it, I'll make a long story short. When I went to Cleveland in 1966, I didn't do particularly well over there. But I did make a lot of appearances, and I guess I was as good a relief pitcher as he had over there. And at the end of the season, I was making the 42.5. Gabe Paul cut me the full 25%, cut me almost $11,000, and that was a major family adjustment. And to give you an analogy, Rocky Colavito, who played for us in Cleveland, great hitter, was making $64,000 that year. He was also cut the full 25%, $16,000, after he hit 33 home runs, had 105 RBIs, and hit 290. I mean, those stats today bring you about $4 or $5 million. Yeah. And Rocky did that every year. And I always felt that up until just recently, in lieu of the $5, $6, $7 million figures, it's a little crazy to me. I don't understand it. I've always been in favor of the ballplayer and getting as much as they want. But despite what you read and all ball clubs are making money. Some just make more than others for obvious reasons. Radio and TV pay these exorbitant salaries. And you know, you take a team like the New York Yankees or the Mets or the LA Dodgers or the Cubs or the White Sox that are in their major metropolitan areas. As you know, the local TV and radio contracts. The New York Yankees, for example, get $100 million locally for TV. That pays a lot of salaries, Peter. So they can afford to do it. I think it's gotten a little crazy, and people ask me almost daily, where is it going to stop? Well, it's going to stop when the advertisers stop paying TV people money for advertising, and that's the only way it's going to stop. And, you know, with the economy the way it is now, I think it's somewhere that's going to level off. But don't ask me. I guess maybe we'll live long enough to see the day of the $10 or $15 million ball player. But all I know is every time the second baseman for the Cubs that just signed,
Ryan Sandberg,
he gets paid $11,000 every time he goes to bat. And whether he hits a two-hopper back to the pitcher or hits a home run, he's going to make $11,000. I can't fathom that, Peter. It's that's beyond me. But I've always said, let the ballplayers make what they want, and I've never had a problem with it. Do I get a little envious? You bet.
Yeah.
You bet. But here again, I just think back, and although it was 30 years ago, I was rich in my own mind back in those days. So I quite honestly, I don't know what I do with $5 million a year anyway.
Okay. Today we see closes with 40, 50, 60 saves in a season. Your maximum number of saves was 29. Are the criteria different today than when you played? If they are, what do you think you might have achieved for figures? And this, again, is purely speculation.
Well, there was a stat. As you mentioned, 29 saves was my best year. That was in 1964, I believe. When I had the 16 wins, that was a great year for me. The criteria is different. Back in our day, we simply had to face the winning or a tying run. It had to be on the plate or on base, and that was it. Nowadays, it seems to me, I don't know what all the criteria is now, but it seems to me if you finish a ball game and you win, you get a save, no matter what the score is. And it seems, I know I'm being a little facetious, but I'm not far from wrong.
Yeah.
And it was figured out by somebody in the Red Sox public relations department a couple of years ago when somebody hit 45 or 50 saves, and I finished 67 ball games in 1964. I pitched in 79, finished 67, of which the 67 we won 62, and they figured it out that I would have saved, along with 16 wins, I would have saved I think 43 or 44 ball games that year. So here again, it's all relative. You know, it's a little crazy, but more power to them.
Like I said, I'm not much of a stats person. You know, they don't really mean much to me. During your playing days, you were known as the Monster. What were your thoughts on this nickname, and did it suit your personality?
Well, that's a good question. I'll tell you how I got the name. Not many people know this, close friends do, but I struck out Mickey Mantle in Yankee Stadium in 1962, my rookie year with the bases loaded, then the ballgame when we won. And when he left home plate, he called me a no-good boomity-boom, a lot of four-letter adjectives, and in the middle there somewhere was Monster. And he said it so loud, the people in the press deck heard him, and they picked up on, of course, the way they went with it, and I never minded it at all. The Boston Herald back in those days wanted to run a contest, and did, to rename Dick Raddatz. Why they did that, I don't know, but they came up with something like Smokey the Bear, and I said, let's go back to the Monster. But the name never bothered me, Peter. I guess in a way, it's sort of, you know, of course, I'm 6'6", and I was 250 pounds in those days, and I was a pretty big guy, and I guess I was a little bit fierce when I was on the mound. I had the good fastball, and I wasn't opposed to brushing people back, and I never smiled much in those days, so I guess to answer your question, I think when I put the uniform on, I had a little bit of a monster in me, but I like to think when I came off the field, I was a little bit different. I think I was, but the name never really did bother me.
Good.
Especially coming from him, I took it as a compliment.
Okay, during your career, you played in some of the old-time ballparks, Griffith Stadium.
I never played in Griffith.
You never played in Griffith?
I was in it, but I never played in it.
Okay. What's your thoughts on some of these stadiums that you played in? Where were you successful? Where weren't you? Just basic thoughts on these stadiums.
Okay, Fenway Park. They always say it's not a park to pitch in. I beg to differ. I felt it was the left field wall and the Green Monster sort of evened out a little bit. It never bothered me. The fellows that took advantage of that wall were guys like Killebrew and some of those people hit the long fly ball. Sometimes the ball would go 330 feet and it'd be a home run, where in Minnesota, where he played, it would have been an out. And on the other side of the coin, guys like Al Kaline would come in, great hitter. hit line drives off the top of the wall that would have been home runs in Detroit, but Carl would hold them to a single or a double. So I thought the wall sort of evened out. Right field was more than fair, and of course center field was a pretty good poke too. The park that I really enjoyed pitching in the most, oddly enough, was Yankee Stadium. It was short down the lines, but very big in the alleys, and I had good luck with the Yankees anyway. I was 10-1, I think, lifetime against them, and I got an extra treat pitching against them. Of course, that lineup was awesome. I think I was scared, and I had to put a little bit more on my fastball, but I enjoyed pitching in Yankee Stadium. Detroit was an awful tough park to pitch in. Left field was comparatively short. Right field was real scary. It was in an 8-foot fence and an overhang that hung out, and it didn't go out very far. It was only 360 to the power alleys, and a lot of fly balls went out in that ballpark. When the ball went up in the air in Detroit, you held your breath. But, of course, when I played for the Cubs, Wrigley Field was a pretty ballpark. Something not unlike Fenway, it was old at its characteristics with the ivy. Also a very tough park to pitch in, short all the way around. I played a couple years in the National League, and I'm more familiar with Kansas City, the old ballpark. It was a great park to pitch, and that was a big ballpark. Oddly enough, I hit my only home run there. I don't know how I did it, but I did, and that was a good park to pitch in. But parks like Detroit, and don't get me wrong, Boston was no picnic to pitch in. It was a small park, especially at left field. But quite honestly, Peter, no park bothered me when I got on the mound. I sort of blocked out where I was, and I've always said the only good park to pitch in is Yellowstone.
When you were playing professional ball, and again, let's go back to the minor leagues, how did travel vary? When you got to the bigs, obviously you were by plane. Minors, I'm sure, was bus or train. And did the amount of traveling you had to do bother you at all?
No, it never bothered me, but it did vary. I was fortunate enough, Carl and I both were fortunate enough to jump. Of course, in those days they had B, C, and D ball, which they don't have anymore. But we both started out in B ball, and the bus in Raleigh, North Carolina was something to behold. Half the windows were gone. What seats were in the bus had springs sticking out of them. A lot of guys slept in the luggage racks. That's when I used to be able to fit in one. I couldn't anymore, but fortunately, in the Carolina League, there wasn't a whole lot of overnight travel. Winston-Salem was the only town we stayed overnight in, so that wasn't too bad. And it was so hot in that league, Peter. The bus was obviously, I don't even know if they had air conditioning in vehicles in those days, but the bus obviously wasn't air conditioned, and it was pretty hot. And of course, when I went to Minneapolis, we flew there, and that was a real treat. But traveling from Boston to L.A. was never a bother to me. Yeah, I could feel the jet lag. You'd get to the ballpark, you know, especially if we flew out the morning of a game. If we had to play L.A. at night and we flew out that morning from Boston, well, first of all, we lost 3 hours. We left Boston at 8 o'clock. It was a six-hour flight. We got to L.A. at 2 o'clock their time. It was 5 Boston time. We went to the hotel, checked in, got a sandwich, went right to the ballpark. It would affect you a little bit. We finally, you saw a lot of guys sleeping in the bullpen before they had to go in and pitch, but overall, the traveling didn't bother me.
All right. What, if any, injuries did you sustain during your professional career?
I never had any injuries. Knock on wood. I was fortunate in that respect. A lot of people that are fans in this town still think I burned myself out or they burned me out. That wasn't the case. I really pitched when I wanted to. And fortunately for me, except for some periods in 1965, all my years here were very good, Peter, and the fans were very good to me. I think I got caught up in that. And there was one time I pitched 9 days in a row. At least a half a dozen instances where I pitched 4 or 5 games in a row. That's sort of unheard of now, and I don't mean just a third of an inning. Sometimes I pitched 9 innings twice. A lot of times I pitched 4 or 5 or 6 innings in one stretch, but I didn't mind it. I really didn't. And it would have been nice if I could do like they do now. They pitch a third or two-thirds or at the most one inning and maybe only 2 or 3 times a week. That's fun.
Did any particular batters give you a hard time? And conversely, any you had an easy time with yourself?
Yeah, I think all major leaguers, whether they're a hitter or a pitcher or whatever, have favorite guys they like to pitch against and or hit off of whatever, and I had my favorites, and I had my guys that I didn't like. I think the popular consensus of opinion in the 1960s especially, nobody There was a couple that I've talked to. Bill Mon Bouquet was one of them, but nobody liked to pitch against Tony Oliva. Mm-hmm. Tony Oliva was a great, great hitter, and I hope someday he goes in the Hall of Fame. But Tony was a Wade Boggs with power. Mm-hmm. Very, very scary. Great contact hitter and an awful tough. And I pitched against Mays, Aaron, Clemente, Mantle, and all of them. I think Tony Oliva was probably the most dangerous hitter I ever faced. And a lot of people say the same thing. Tony Kubek hit me very, very well. Although I had great luck with the Yankees, I remember the first time I ever faced Tony Kubek in Yankee Stadium when he came out of the service in 62. I was told that he was a good fastball hitter. And I, cocky as I was, I said, well, he hasn't seen my fastball. Make a long story short, I pitched 9 innings in relief one night against the Yankees, and I beat Marshall Bridges in the 17th inning. I struck out 12 or 13 in relief, and I gave up 4 hits. Tony Kubek was 4 for 4. He got them all. And from that day on, I think if he had 270 lifetime, he had about 265 of it off of me. Got his last big league hit off of me, a 3-run homer in Fenway, 1965, the last day of the season. And Tony was tough for me. Quite honestly, Peter, the guys that were rough on me were the left-handed Punch and Judy hitters, not unlike Boggs. Guys that were tough for me to strike out. I didn't have the ability to throw the good breaking pitch. There was occasions when I had a pretty good slider and I would use it, but 3 out of 4 times I relied on my fastball, and I had great control with it, and I could make it sink or rise, so it was almost like having 2 pitches. But those fellas stand out. I had great success with Mickey Mantle. I take a lot of pride. He just sent me a poster, an autograph to me of him. They called me the greatest pitcher he'd ever faced and toughest pitcher he'd ever faced, and boy, that's up in a real nice prominent spot in my home. But I faced Mickey, I think, 63 times. I struck him out 47 times. Wow. He got 1 hit off, and it was a home run in Yankee Stadium. He's so strong. He thought he popped it up and went over the 400-foot mark in right field, and Roger Maris was waiting for him at home plate. I've got a picture at home. They're both pointing at me, and standing home plate, and what Mickey's saying is, you know good so-and-so. It took me 5 years, but I finally got you.
He was retired when you came up, but I'm sure he was down a Winter Haven or wherever spring training, Scottsdale. Did you ever get to face Ted?
No, I never did. And oddly enough, Ted Williams and I today are very good friends, although we never played against each other. I think Ted had a lot of respect for me, you know, when he saw me pitch. And Ted Williams is the type of guy, Peter, that when he's with other ballplayers, he doesn't like yes men. He'll sit and elaborate, pontificate, if you will, for an hour or 2 hours and end without taking a breath. And if you agree with, sit there and nod your head and agree with everything, he doesn't want to talk to you anymore. He loves to argue. And the first time I ever met him, I was warming up in Scottsdale, and he was standing behind me, and I didn't know it. And I was throwing it pretty good. I was 90-plus, and I was popping it up there pretty good. And I turned around to pick up the rosin bag, and he was standing behind me. I said, Mr. Williams, how are you? He said, is that it? And I said, well, I'm throwing pretty good. And he said, you better take that over the minor league fields. He said, you'll never get anybody out with that. I immediately said, I'll tell you what, it's good enough to get you out. I know that. Well, he lost it. He said, you couldn't get me out. And that night we had dinner together, and we've been friends ever since. Fortunately, Peter, I never had to face him. I don't think I would have liked to have had to make a living facing Ted Williams.
What are you most proud of in your major league career?
Well, I'm especially proud of the first 3 or 4 years I had here in Boston, Peter. Those were outstanding years for me personally. Unfortunately, we didn't have good ball clubs. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that. I think the only thing I ever missed in baseball was a chance not to play in a World Series. I just missed the Cubs. That 1 year we were in first place in September, we lost out to the Cardinals. Of course, I left the Red Sox in 66, and they won it in 67. I joined the Tigers in 69, they won it in 68, but half hour late and a dollar short. But that's the one thing, that one glaring thing that I think I missed in my career. I would have liked to have had a few more years, too, but such as it is, I thought the first 3 or 4 years here in Boston were outstanding for me personally. I take a lot of pride in the fact that I pitched in the 63 and 64 All-Star games. I was the first relief pitcher, pure relief pitcher, chosen to an All-Star team. And I take a lot of pride in that. Probably that, maybe more so than anything else.
Really? Okay. Just the opposite. What was your biggest disappointment in your career?
Biggest disappointment in my career is when I got traded from the Boston Red Sox to the Cleveland Indians. Not the fact that I was going to Cleveland, the fact that I was leaving Boston. I thought it was a little premature. I still do to this day. I got off to a rather slow start in 66. I was 0-2, and the papers were coming a little heavy. Is he done? Is he through? And Haywood Sullivan was then the general manager, new general manager. I think I was the first fellow he ever traded, but He traded me to Cleveland, and it literally broke my heart. I had a sort of a love affair with the people here in Boston. I thought the reverse was true too. I think I gave them a lot of thrills, and they gave me a lot of thrills. They were like an extra 5 miles on my fastball, especially when I played in Fenway. But it really, really bothered. I never did recover from it. I went into Cleveland, and although Cleveland had a pretty good ball club, we were young. We had the Teons and the Sonny Sieberts and the Sam McDowells, and of course my roommate Gary Bell, who later came over here and did quite well. But I think that was probably the biggest single disappointment I ever had.
All right. What we're going to do now, okay, I've listed some players you played with.
Okay.
And I've been doing this with all the people I've been interviewing. In one or two, three sentences, just describe these people that you played with, okay? Gene Conley.
Gene Conley, dear friend, very competitive, probably other than Bo Jackson, the best two-sport athlete I've ever seen, and just a joy to play with, and a very, very tough competitor.
Pumpsy Green.
Well, Pumpsy was, as everybody knows, I think the first black ever to play with the Boston Red Sox, and I think even Pumpsy knew that he didn't have the talent to really play in the big leagues at that time, but a wonderful guy, and he handled himself very, very well in a tough town that's always had a reputation of being a little prejudiced, and I think Pumpsy was a joy to play with. I really did.
I mentioned these two first because I want to know the truth about their trip to Israel.
Well, I'll make a long story short. I was on the bus when it happened, and they got off the bus to go to the lavatory. We were in a tremendous traffic jam in downtown New York, going over to New Jersey to catch a charter to go to Washington. This was on a Wednesday afternoon. Thursday was an off day. Friday night, we didn't play till Friday night. And Gene asked Pinky Higgins, our manager, if he could go to the bathroom. Pinky says, where? He said, in that bar right there. He said, I'll be right back. So Pumpsy said, well, I have to go too. Well, Pumpsy picks up the story from here. As Gene passed the bartender, he just held two fingers, said, two Budweiser, we'll be right back. Well, you can imagine what happened from there on. They said, the heck with the bus, we'll take a cab and beat the bus. The heck with the cab, we'll take a plane in tomorrow, and we're not playing tomorrow. And all of a sudden, it was Sunday, and they had missed three games. And Pumpsy did come to the ballpark on Sunday. Gene was so embarrassed, he just went back to Foxborough, actually, to his wife. And Gene, to this day, is embarrassed about that. I always felt that the pressure of playing two sports might have caught up with him a little bit. Matter of fact, I've got a radio show here in Brockton that I do every other Monday night, and I had Gene as my guest. And off when we weren't on the mic, he told me, he said, you don't want to know anything about Israel? I said, Gene, I know about Israel. I said, I'm not going to embarrass you. He said, I appreciate that. It still bothers him, but it was something. It was something. He was, I think the pressure of the two sports really caught up with him, Peter.
Okay. Second baseman, won a couple of batting titles for the Red Sox, Pete Reynolds.
Yeah, I played with Pete 2 years. Great guy, very professional. When he came to the ballpark, he came to play, and he's gone now. We lost him just recently, and it's a big loss. I had a lot of admiration for Pete Reynolds.
If I'm correct, he was a 1961 Rookie of the Year. Don Schwall?
Don Schwall, I'm going to see, and I haven't seen in over 20 years, Peter. Very successful stockbroker in Pittsburgh. And that's where we traded for Dick Stewart when we got Jack LeMabe and Jim Pagliarone left. And I'm looking forward to seeing him when I go to Pittsburgh this summer. And a good friend, Don and I, Don's from my hometown, from Michigan. He's from Ypsilanti, Michigan. Of course, I'm from north of Detroit. But we played some amateur ball against each other. I'm giving you more than three sentences here. But
no,
I'm looking forward to seeing Don, and it's been a long time.
Another relief pitcher for the Sox, Mike Fornelis.
Yeah, Mike was sort of my mentor. I took over his job here in Boston. And instead of being upset the fact that I was in to take over his job, he was a tremendous help to me and taught me a little about the inside, some of the ropes about short relief pitching. Great asset to me.
Okay, a guy I admired, even though I wasn't a pitcher, was Earl Wilson. He was one of the first ones that I can remember that was, and again, I was just a kid, was probably a power pitcher. And really looked up to him and thought a lot of him, and I was disappointed personally when he was traded.
Yeah, well, Earl Wilson and I were traded a week apart. Earl went to Detroit, where I would have loved to go because it was my hometown, and of course I went to Cleveland. Earl and I are very close, even to this day. First black pitcher ever to pitch for the Red Sox. Tough, great athlete. Signed as a catcher originally. What happened to him was he was a lousy hitting catcher who became a good hitting pitcher. As you know, he hit 30-some career home runs, and Earl was a treat to play with.
Bill Mambuquette, a local boy.
Toughest competitor I ever played with. I mean, Mambuquette, I think a fellow that's pitching now who is very like Mambuquette was Jack Morris. Bill, even though I had great seasons with the Red Sox in the early 60s when Bill was at the height of his career, didn't like me coming into ball games. If he had a lead, he wanted to take the ball and win or lose it himself. I had a lot of admiration for Bill. Very, very good competitor.
Now, this next one, I was told by a friend of mine that you kind of had a special relationship with him and that you helped him out a lot, saved quite a few of his games. This was in this person's recollection. That was Dave Moorhead.
Yeah, Dave was a good kid. Oddly enough, couldn't get his fastball over the plate. He had a great curveball. Back in those days, Camilio Pascual was the curveball pitcher in our league. He had three of them, and Dave was very close to that. Dave, oddly enough, couldn't get his fastball over, and he had a good one. And then he got in some arm troubles. But I had some luck saving some games for David, and Dave had a tendency to be a little wild sometimes. So if he got wild in the late innings, I'd pick him up. Good friend. We were very good friends.
Old Stone Gloves, Dick Stewart.
I room with Dick Stewart, because nobody else would. And I don't know why, because he's a funny, funny man. Dick Stewart's feeling about baseball was, I do one thing very, very well, and that's to hit the ball out of the ballpark. He said, if you want me to pick the ball up at first base, that's going to cost you more money. Quite honestly, I thought he was just a little bit lazy, Peter. You'd hit the ball at Dick, he'd pick it up. Mm-hmm. Not all the time, but most of the time, as good as most. But don't ask him to go 2 feet to his right or his left. He didn't have all the energy to do that. But I'll tell you, he was a great, great hitter. I don't know what his stats are. I think he was a 270 lifetime hitter. But a tremendously strong human being. He was the unchallenged, not only baseball, but professional sports arm wrestling champion. He was always strong. He could get out on his front foot, have his bat committed, his legs committed, re-cocking a curveball with his arms and hit 450 feet. He was a tremendously strong man. Fun guy, very witty. I miss Dick a little bit.
Another one I grew up admiring, third baseman Frank Melzone.
Most professional I ever played with. Nobody admired Frank more than I did because there's nobody on that ball club. My 5 years in Boston, including Yastrzemski, Conigliaro, whoever, that I wanted up in a tight situation more than Frank Melzone. Although Frank struck out his share of times, Frank always had the ability in tough situations to get the bat and the ball. Brooks Robinson undoubtedly was probably as good a third baseman as any of us have ever seen. Frank Melzone was just a hair behind him. Frank Melzone won 3 gold gloves when Brooks Robinson was in the league. So that tells you a little bit about how good Frank was at third base, but a pro's pro.
Journeyman ball player, became one of baseball's premier managers during the 60s, 70s, Dick Williams.
I played with Dick Williams. I'm glad I didn't have to play for him. One of the few guys that I didn't really have a strong relationship with as a ball player. Dick, I think, was a little frustrated at the end of his career. Dick had played a lot of years, and from what I understand, he had the potential to be a great outfielder for the Brooklyn Dodgers back in the days of Brooklyn. Hurt his arm severely, lost his ability to throw the ball. Still was a pretty good hitter right up till the end, but frustration set in, and he sat on the bench knowing that he couldn't play anywhere. He wanted to play the outfield, but we had Conigliaro, Yastrzemski, and Gary Geiger. He thought maybe he could play first. We had Dick Stewart. There was no place for him to play. Did I not like Dick? No, I didn't like him. I just bothered me a little bit.
Tony Conigliaro.
I would agree with most critics about Tony. I think if good Lord willing hadn't got hit with the pitch, I think Tony would have been probably in the Hall of Fame today. Youngest man ever to hit 100 home runs. Had the guts of a burglar, Peter. He was probably to the point where it hurt him.
I remember watching him run into walls.
Well, Pedro Ramos, for example, comes up. This is a long story. I'll make it short. Pedro broke his wrist in April 1 year. Tony stood right on top of the plate and wouldn't give in, wouldn't get out of the way. And Pedro broke his wrist in April and then broke his collarbone again in July. And Tony still wouldn't get out of the way. And, of course, Jack Hamilton, the fellow that hit him and sort of not only curtailed his career, more or less just about ended it, had the reputation of being somewhat of a headhunter. Now, I'm not going to accuse Jack of throwing at Tony, but Jack wouldn't back down to anybody. Of course, Tony wouldn't either, hence here came the injury. But Tony just wouldn't give in, and I think it was probably his undoing. But, boy, he had a lot of guts. He was a tough kid.
Another one I admired, and he was kind of a journeyman ball player, was Dalton Jones. He always seemed to come through in the clutch. I remember watching several games on TV where he'd hit him in Detroit with that short porch in right field.
Dalton Jones was playing today, Peter, and Detroit had a shot at him. He'd played for 50 years in Detroit. Ballpark's made for left-handed hitters anyway, and Dalton really took advantage of that ballpark. Dalton Jones didn't have a particular position that he played very, very well. He came up as an infielder, as you know, played third, played second, played some short, none of them very well, adequate at best, but he could hit. One surprise I had about Dalton Jones as the years went on, just a couple years ago, I checked his lifetime batting average. I thought Dalton was maybe a 280 lifetime batter, 238, but I'll tell you what, it was a strong 238.
You were traded and to several clubs. One of them was Sonny Siebert.
Yeah, I went over to Cleveland, and as I mentioned earlier in the interview, that pitching staff was a little before its time with Louie, Sam McDowell, Sonny Siebert, Steve Hargan, Gary Bell, who I became very close with, room with Gary. We had Fred Whitfield, Max Elvis, Leon Wagner, Chuck Hinton, pretty good catching crew with Joe Askew, and Duke Sims. We had a ball club that should have done a lot better. I think the overall, and Rocky Colavito, of course, I think the overall attitude of the club was negative because of Gabe Paul, the way he treated us, what I related on salaries. I don't think anybody enjoyed playing there. I know the day that I got traded to the Cubs from Cleveland, they put out a record in the clubhouse, "Please release me, let me go." That was sort of the theme song of the Cleveland Indians.
Okay, you just mentioned him, Rocky Colavito.
Yeah, right behind Frank Melzone. It's funny, the most professional guys I ever played with both were Italian. I don't know what that means, but Rocky Colavito was a pro's pro, very businesslike when his approach to the game, a real pro's pro, a classy guy, handsome gentleman, never embarrassed himself, very strong, and just a very businesslike ball player who I had a lot of respect for.
Guy I first came in contact with through the 57-58 World Series was a catcher for the Milwaukee Braves, was Del Crandall.
Yeah.
And you probably played with him towards the end of his career.
I did. I played with Del in Cleveland, and here again, another pro's pro, a very nice man. You know, he'd fool around with the kids and have a good time, but when it came time to be a pro, he was the ultimate. And they hired Del specifically back in 1966 and 7 to catch Sam McDowell. Sam McDowell wasn't exactly the next neutron rocket scientist, and they hired Del to sort of take care of Sam. Whenever Sam pitched, Del would catch. It helped Sam some, but Sam was a little bullheaded, but Del Crandall was a real pro's pro, and a man that I see occasionally still, and it's a pleasure always to see him. He exudes good feelings out of me. I like Del a lot.
Okay, young guy, young first baseman. My wife's favorite ball player, George Scott.
Well, there's the one that liked him, huh? Boomer had a lot of talent. A great, probably as good a first baseman as I ever saw. I think a lot of people would say the same thing. Vic Power was excellent, too, but Boomer was as good as anybody around the bag. Dangerous, dangerous hitter. Very strong. I don't know what his lifetime was. I guess Boomer probably ended up hitting about 280. But big free swinger, always dangerous, and unfortunately, he's trying to find a job in baseball now. Can't he burn too many bridges behind him? But a heck of a competitor.
A young Cuban, Louis Tiant.
Funniest man I ever met. Not to mention his 229 wins, which I don't think borders on being a Hall of Famer. I think he should be. And I've always been of the opinion, Peter, that a lot of guys that are in the Hall of Fame did it because they did it during prime time. During the World Series. Louis pitched in the World Series and lost. They lost the World Series in 75. Louis won two games in that series. Quite honestly, hit the ball pretty good, too. The Red Sox didn't win it, and I think that maybe and a couple of other things might have caused him to stay out of the Hall of Fame, but I think he's definitely got credentials to get in there.
Okay, a young Fergie Jenkins over in Chicago.
Fergie Jenkins was mature beyond his years, Peter. When I played with him in 67, I think it was his second year in the league, and he was already pitching like he was 30, 35 years old. As good a control as I ever saw on a pitcher that had the stuff that he had, great fastball, great slider. Never did he throw the ball above the waist, and he was very, very tough. I compared him a lot to Bob Gibson. Gibson threw a little bit harder than Fergie did, but Fergie was as good a pitcher. I put him in the class with guys like Koufax. Sandy was the best I ever saw, but for pure pitching ability with good stuff, you think about the Marischals, the Seavers, and the Jenkins.
Okay, on the same team was an older Ernie Banks, Mr. Cub.
Ernie Banks was, here again, a pro's pro, a very classy guy, and loved to play the game of baseball. And I caught him at the end of his career, but I wish I'd had a chance to see him 10 years before that, Peter. But even at the end of his career, when I got him in 66 and 67, it was a treat for me to play with him.
Okay. Maury Wills. You must have played with him up in Montreal.
No, I didn't. Maury wasn't at Montreal, but I played against him. Although I played against Lou, I played against Lou 1 year, 2 years, Lou Brock, a great, obviously, Hall of Famer. Maury was, I thought, the best pure base runner I ever saw, Peter, because he didn't have real good speed, but he knew how to run the bases. The man would take a lead off, you swear, you could kick the ball over and pick him off, but you couldn't pick him off. He knew how to run the bases. There were faster guys in that ball club, Willie Davis being one, but Maury was the ultimate base stealer. Great ball player, pretty good hitter, too.
Rusty Staub.
Rusty Staub, Le Grand Orange. I did play with him in Montreal. Great hitter. Great hitter. Nice man. Here again, here's another guy. If he could have remained just a DH, he probably would have played till he was 50. But no position, really, that he excelled at. Tried the outfield play first. Didn't do particularly well at either one. But as probably one of the top 10 hitters I ever saw.
Someone you didn't play with in the major leagues, but you played college ball with them, and I remember reading about your relationship with them when I was a kid reading it in the papers, was Ron Peronowski.
Probably as close a friend as I have, Peter. Ron, of course, now he's the pitching coach for the Los Angeles Dodgers. Probably, if not the most respected pitching coach of the game, certainly one of the top two or three. Our careers sort of paralleled each other. I think I got a little more ink than Ron did, only because I struck people out. And that, it's like the home run. You know, people talk about home runs and strikeouts. Ron Peronowski was 16-3 in 1963 when the Dodgers won it, but nobody knew it because of Koufax and Drysdale. Probably one of the most unheralded all-time great relief pitchers in the game. Raleigh Fingers Hall of Fame, rightly so. You talk about the Suitors and the Quisenberries and some of the fellows that are playing now, but Ron Peronowski was as tough a relief pitcher as the game ever saw.
How about your managers at the major league level?
Johnny Pesky was my favorite. I started out with Pinky Higgins in 62, and of course Pesky came in 63, and of course Johnny and I had been in the minor leagues together, and it wasn't a manager-player relationship. We became very good friends. And I played for Johnny in 63 and 64. He was my favorite. And then Billy Herman came. I didn't feel one way or another about Billy Herman. I played for Joe Adcock and Bertie Tebbets in Cleveland. Both good guys. I enjoyed Bertie. He was a real character, but he knew his game. And I enjoyed playing for Bertie. Played for Leo DeRocher with the Cubs. I have no comment on Leo DeRocher. I played for Mayo Smith, who I also have no comment about. Probably the poorest of the managers I ever played for. Norm Cash said in 1968, we won it despite him, and I think that's very true. In 1969, I ended up with Montreal after I left Detroit, and played for a guy I had a lot of admiration for, and what was said about him I thought was true. Gene Mauch likes the older ball players, and I played for him twice. I played for him in Minneapolis before he went and took over the Phillies, and I played for him as my last manager, and he liked me a lot more 8 years later when I was older, but he knew his baseball. I had a lot of respect for Gene, but Johnny was my favorite.
Okay. How about umpires? Did you have any particular favorites?
Yep.
Any you didn't like?
You bet. Nestor Shalak was great. I think the consensus of anybody who played back in those years will tell you that Nestor was probably as good as anybody. Peter, the thing that ball players like about umpires is, that, number one, if they hustle and they're on time, and we know they're going to blow a play once in a while. But Nestor was always a hustler. Eddie Hurley was a good umpire, although he had the smallest strike zone in the world. We knew that, and so we'd pitch accordingly. Hank Sorer was a very good umpire. I had a lot of respect for Hank. The one that stands out in my mind who was an absolute yo-yo was Frank Eumont. I hate to talk about the dead because he just passed away, but Frank umpired a game like he just happened to walk by the ballpark and thought he'd go in and do somebody a favor. He's the only man ever threw me out of a game, and he meant to. He goaded me, and he called seven straight strikes, seven straight balls, and he threw me out in Fenway Park. Johnny Pesky absolutely saved my career. Because he walked down when we were changing pitchers after he threw me out. He walked down to Yogi Berra at first base, and he said, I finally got that Raddatz. And I left the dugout. I was going to sock him. I really was. And Pesky tackled me, and he said, boy, you hit that umpire, you're never going to play again. Probably saved my career. But for a brief moment, I blacked out. But Frank Eumont was not one of my favorites.
Okay, I'm going to switch this.
Okay.